for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. The Obama administration has increased the use of targeted assassinations, such as the drone strikes in Pakistan. Secretary of Defense Robert Gates arrived in Islamabad today on an unannounced visit. He's expected to try to convince Pakistan's leaders that drone strikes are essential to the fight against extreme groups. Joining me in the studio, James Kitfield of the National Journal, Paul Pillar of the Center for Peace and Security Studies at Georgetown University. Joining us from the Argo Network in New York is Henna Shamsi. She's senior advisor to the UN Special Rapporteur in Extrajudicial Executions at New York University Law School. We do invite your calls, questions, comments. Call us on 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. You can also join us on Facebook and Twitter. Good morning to you, James.
Good morning.
And to you, Paul.
Good morning, Diane.
Good morning, Henna Shamsi.
Good morning, Diane.
Thank you for joining us. James Kitfield, you wrote about this secret program in the National Journal. What do we know about it? How does the planning go? Who decides?
Well, there's a lot we don't know, which is really one of the more fascinating things about this. Basically, we know that there are various lists, targeted assassination lists, if you will. They don't call them that. They have different names for them. Different agencies and different geographical military commands have different lists, but they all get eventually vetted at the level of the National Security Council. And it operates under a president executive finding shortly after 9/11 that we could use lethal covert action in the war on terror. And they interpreted Congress's broad powers that Congress has passed out authorization for military force after 9/11 that basically said the administration could do what it was needed to do to protect America. So we really are working. I mean, one thing we should make very clear at the outset, Diane, is that, you know, we have a war on poverty. We have a war on drugs. That's a rhetorical flourish. The war on terror, we're operating under wartime rules. It's a real war.
What are the criteria for someone to be put on that list?
Well, that's a really interesting thing because we don't know, and they won't tell us. It's totally classified. It is briefed to Congress, but in closed session before the intelligence committees, and they don't tell us. As one senior administration official who's very knowledgeable on this told me, let's put it this way, the easiest way to get on that list is to have anything to do, any linkage whatsoever to Al-Qaeda.
And how much has the program been expanded?
It's been expanded dramatically, I mean, which is kind of interesting because the Obama administration and President Obama himself have dropped the sort of war on terror construct and the rhetorical construct. But he has mentioned the war on Al-Qaeda, and he has kept these wartime authorities in expanding this program dramatically. He's launched more drone strikes, for instance. Drone strikes are the most obvious iteration of this. They're not the only one. There are other kinds of target assassinations that we have done. But the drone strikes are very obvious, and he has almost doubled what Bush did in his last year, and that year was the most that Bush in all of his 8 years in office. So it's been dramatically increased recently. We learned over the summer that there was a nascent operation to establish CIA hit squads to go out. The CIA director, Leon Panetta, took that over to Congress and said this never went operational, but it was in the planning stages. We also have learned that that was being contracted out to Blackwater, now XC Services, in the process of being contracted out. And we've learned also from a Senate Foreign Relations report that the target list has gone beyond terrorism. It's now, for instance, in Afghanistan, more than 50 drug dealers are on this. They are not terrorists. They have not proclaimed war in the United States, but their operations are seen as funding the insurgency tied to some of the terrorist groups. So that, you know, it's already a triple bank shot where the target list is growing.
James Kitfield, he's senior correspondent for National Journal magazine. He wrote the article Wanted Dead about the Obama administration's use of targeted assassinations in the war against Al-Qaeda. Turning to you, Hannah Shumsey, is the use of targeted assassinations legal?
Well, Diane, the answer really depends on a number of factors, and they are all considered under the international law of armed conflict or international humanitarian law. And as James said, we don't know enough about the criteria and the facts to which this program is applied to, in fact, determine whether it is legal or not. We don't know, for example, where the U.S. has determined people can be targeted and who, in fact, can be targeted. Under international law, targeted killings are legitimate only if they occur within the context of an armed conflict. And so the question is, does the United States think still, as the Bush administration did, that the world is a global battlefield? Two, in order for the targeting to be legitimate, a determination has to be made that the use of force is necessary to meet a military objective and that capture of the person is not possible. And critically, precautions have to be taken to minimize injury to civilians, and the expected harm to civilians has got to be proportionate to the military advantage. We simply do not have enough information to know whether any of those criteria are being applied by, for example, the CIA, and whether they are being met. We don't know what the administration's justification is for targeting people who, under the laws of war, may count as civilians as opposed to combatants who may be fired upon.
Hannah Shumsey, she's senior advisor to the UN Special Rapporteur on Extrajudicial Executions at New York University School of Law. She is a lecturer in law on international human rights at Columbia Law School. And turning to you now, Paul Pillar, it sounds as though we're talking about a ratio of military to civilian deaths.
Well, that's one thing that one ought to take into account in deciding whether it is prudent or not prudent to undertake these operations. Let me just summarize what the basic pros and cons are of these things, with particular reference to the drone strikes, which is the main thing we're talking about. On the advantage side, the most obvious one is a bad guy is taken out of commission, or at least a suspected bad guy. There are the indirect effects that have often been cited as well, keeping the terrorist off balance, keeping them confused, keeping them fearful of who might have ratted on them, basically. And the idea of a unmanned device flying 2 miles above you that can find you wherever you are, even if you're relaxing on the roof of your house, keeps the terrorist in a state of not just fear, but keeps them from concentrating on their offensive operations. On the negative side, the main thing is the rancor and ill will and resentment over the United States using this particular instrument of force, and particular using it in a way that has caused considerable collateral damage.
And is that one of the reasons that Defense Secretary Gates is in Islamabad today?
Certainly, because the one reflection of the fact that for many Pakistanis, it's not only the Pakistanis, but for many Pakistanis, this is not a proper use of force. It is something that they're angry about. One reflection of that is the public posture of the Pakistani government. However much they might be cooperating in secret with us, they do not want to acknowledge that they approve of or are part of the drone strikes, and in fact, ritualistically denounce them.
Paul Pillar, he's director of graduate studies at the Center for Peace and Security Studies at Georgetown University. He's a former CIA National Intelligence Officer. Do join us 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. James Kitfield, tell us about the targeted killing by Tula Massoud.
That was an interesting case. It happened last August 5th. Tula Massoud is a very bad guy. I mean, we should state that out front. He is the head of the Pakistan Taliban, which bombed the Marriott Hotel a couple of years ago, killing more than 50 people, thought to be involved in the assassination of Benazir Bhutto. And he has sort of taken up this mantle of trying to destabilize Pakistan, which something causes us a lot of concern because there's a lot of extremists in Pakistan. It's a weak central government, and they have nuclear weapons. So he's a scary guy. He was in Waziristan in the tribal areas where we think al-Qaeda is holed up. He was receiving medical treatment on the roof of his in-law's house. Two Hellfire missiles came down and blew up the whole family and eight others, some security guards. Others were not sure who they were, which raises the question of, so, you know, if you know you're going to have to take out civilians, you know, what is the threshold? Now, you would imagine on most thresholds he would probably qualify because he was a big fish. Perhaps the biggest fish we've gotten since Zarqawi who led al-Qaeda in Iraq in 2005. So he's probably the most, he's kind of the poster boy for this program because you did take out someone. And I also pointed out, too, that he was more of a threat to the Pakistani government. Suggests that, and there has been reporting that there is a secret deal we reached with the Pakistani government last spring that said, we know these strikes are very controversial. We know you don't like them in many cases. We'll give you more authority to pick some of the targets. I think we went after Massoud 15 times before we actually got him. So it does suggest some collusion between the Pakistani government and ourselves because he was a common enemy.
James Kitfield, his article in National Journal Magazine is titled Wanted Dead, all about the Obama administration's use of targeted assassination in the war against al-Qaeda. When we come back, we'll talk more, take your calls, your email. Please join us, 800-433-8850. Talking in this hour about the use of targeted assassinations, which has definitely increased under the Obama administration. Here's a Facebook message from Mark. He says, I lived in Pakistan from 1982 to 1988. Many more innocents have died because these cowards blow up mosques and schools. UAV warfare is by no means the best way to defeat these guys, but is proven very effective. And its innocent life factor will be admired one day for how much less collateral damage is suffered. James Kitfield.
Raises an interesting point. I saw a poll, and it's been validated in a couple of news reports that said that the people who actually live in the tribal areas who are under the heel of al-Qaeda and some of these extremist groups, the drone program is not so unpopular with them. It's more of a nationalistic issue that politicians in a democracy like Pakistan easily play. But I think that there's a key point there. We are not bombing mosques. We are trying to take out bad guys who are doing some of these mosque bombings. So in that sense, I think there is a justification that these are very bad people, and they reside in a place that, even though it's within a sovereign country, is outside the reach of the law of that sovereign country.
Hannah Shumsey, how do you respond to Mark's statement?
Well, I can see the impulse to recognize that there's a great deal of suspicion about people in this location, but I think we should step back and look at the fact that prior to this entire period, in fact, in July 2001, the United States ambassador to Israel, which was conducting a campaign of targeted killings, had said that the U.S. government was very clearly on the record as being against targeted assassination, that they were extrajudicial killings, and that the United States government didn't support that. Now, of course, September 11th happened, and the United States argued that it was at war, and certainly that attack was devastating. The question now is, what are the legal standards that are being used to legitimize or argue that the targeted killings that the United States is conducting are, in fact, legal? And what are the justifications? We simply do not know that. And essentially what you have is a threat to the United States' strategic position and the threat that the tactic will become delegitimized without explanation and, in fact, a threat to the rule of law itself. And again, taking a bigger picture viewpoint, we at the Project on Extrajudicial Executions at NYU, which is where I worked, have tracked the fact that over 40 countries now have drone technology. Not all of it is weaponized, but certainly countries that are both the United States' friends but also its potential enemies have this technology, and they include, or seeking the technology, and they include Iran, Iraq, India, Pakistan, China, Israel, the United Kingdom, and Germany. And so whatever legitimation or justification that the United States has, whatever rules it's applying that are on their face more expansive than what is permitted by international law, may in fact be turned around and used against the United States itself.
Paul Pillar.
The phraseology that Mark used in his statement, I think, reflects some of the thinking in U.S. officialdom. I think he said, it's not the best means, but it's necessary. And I have heard people involved in the making of our policy in, toward Pakistan and Afghanistan make the point, this is one of the few instruments we have in order to strike directly at the people we'd most like to strike directly at in Pakistan, so we're going to use it. Now, of course, that has the hazard of, if you've got this wonderful hammer, you start seeing things that look like nails. But I want to just make one other point that plays off of what Henna said, and that has to do with the whole legitimacy issue. You know, one of the kinds of actions that we have, at least in the past, described as international terrorism, and indeed meets our definition of international terrorism, is extrajudicial, extraterritorial killings. Some of what Iran has done in eliminating political dissidents in Europe, Pakistan, Turkey, and elsewhere, we have counted in all of our reports, in our official commentary on Iran, as international terrorism. Of course, we've been selective in our descriptions. We haven't described what Israel has done, and now we're not describing what we ourselves are doing. But we have to bear this in mind in keeping a distinction between what we do and what terrorists do, and what's legitimate and what's illegitimate.
James Kitfield, one of the things that truly disturbed me about your article is to learn that the drones, the programs, were hacked into by other nations, so that, for example, Iran may know exactly what the U.S. is doing, has done, or perhaps is planning to do. Iraq and even Pakistan itself.
My impression from that story, and it was not a big part of my research, but my impression from that story was there was a vulnerability in the linkage between the drones and the ground stations, and that was exploited by some groups, non-state actors as well. Knowing what I know about these guys, I'm sure that's been fixed. So I doubt that they can still exploit that, but it does show you these things are not perfect. And I also like to go to Hannah's point that we have crossed the Rubicon here. We did. She's right. Martin Indyk, as our ambassador to Israel, did criticize Israel quite strongly on its program. We now face the same threat, which is that you have an organization that's deadly, that's targeting your civilians around the world. So you have to define, so what is the battlefield? A lot of people think Israel went too far by doing assassinations on the streets of Paris and Norway and Beirut. And that seemed to be where we were heading with those CIA hit squads, but we'll never know because we're not told these things. What we do know is that in places where there are, you could argue there's a battlefield, Afghanistan and Iraq, which is really where these programs, you know, got their origin from us anyway, our programs. You know, Joint Special Operations Command has total authority, and they run these programs. They're the lead agency. CIA also involved in these hunter-killer teams, these special task forces. In places where there is no government, like Somalia, this the Joint Special Operations Command feels free itself to rub out these guys, to kill them. As we happened this fall, where Special Forces helicopters surrounded this guy's convoy and lit it up with machine gun fire, Navy SEALs rappel down, grab the bodies, and they take off back to the warships off the coast of Somalia. In places where there is weak government, that's really the gray area. Yemen right now, and also Pakistan. It's clear that we are doing these kinds of things, and it's pretty clear also that there is some complicit cooperation with the governments. But that is really the gray area. That's you know, where the long arm of the law and you're outside what is traditionally defined as a battlefield. That's the gray area, and we've stepped into it with both feet.
How much the CIA's work is being contracted out?
Well, I mean, that was really kind of the fascinating thing that we learned when Leon Panetta, the head of the CIA, took this program over to Congress and briefed them on that, because during the Bush administration, reportedly, Vice President Cheney convinced them that they did not have to be briefed to Congress because it was not operational yet. But what we saw was that the Blackwater, who we all know is the major contractor in a lot of these war zones, had hired the top three guys at the CIA who ran the counterterrorism program. And, you know, lo and behold, the program they were running of target assassinations and then these hit squads they were setting up started to migrate to Blackwater. Vanity Fair did a very good article where they interviewed the head of Blackwater, who on the record says, yes, we were doing this. We were setting up this capability off the books for total deniability by any government or by the CIA, you know, claiming that the CIA would have operational control over everything they did, but total deniability because it was a private contractor. So you can see when you don't have these programs operate in the shadows, they tend to grow because there's no natural fire breaks to them. We saw that also, I think, with the drug dealers. I mean, it's a difficult argument to say some drug dealer, which may include Hamid Karzai's brother, apparently, who's very reportedly tied up into the drug trade, is a direct enemy of the state, you know, that we can assassinate on site. That, to me, is a harder argument, but we don't get to make that argument because this never comes out of the shadows.
Paul Pillar, do you believe that if the American people were put to a referendum on this question, that they would say we'd prefer to continue the use of drones and special ops to take out the bad guys far away, or we'd prefer to do it all legally?
I think, well, as usual, it would be how the referendum is phrased, and that last couple of words you used would raise some issues. But I think overall, the first option, that people, the majority would say, yes, we have to do whatever means that we have, whatever we have available, including forceful means. There's one other point that we need to get out on the table, Diane, that I don't think we've touched on, and that is the possibility, and not just the possibility, but the reality in the past, that sometimes the information is wrong. It is incorrect. And even the Israelis, who are the past masters at this, have had some very unfortunate incidents of false identities, mistaken targets, innocent people being killed because the information was bad. And as I think a former intelligence official was quoted in James' article as saying, it's pretty thin stuff often, that is to say the intelligence, on which to base a death sentence for someone. So that's another of the cons you have to weigh in with the pros and cons. The information might be inaccurate.
Hannah Shamsi.
Well, I think we've got two different things going on here. One is that, as James was referring to, there are all sorts of reasons why the use of drones is attractive and one of the best options out of a number of terrible ones. But the issue is what we have is it's risk management, and it's the use of technology that poses very little risk to the United States and its forces, but so the costs of blood and treasure may decrease, but the risks of killing, of using technology, of using weaponry that may cause harm to civilians don't. And it's those kinds of costs and risks that the law of war regulates. And the law of war has guidance and standards on what constitutes what's called direct participation in hostilities, pursuant to which a civilian loses his or her immunity from being targeted for killing. And James was talking about officials who said that, you know, this program could apply to anyone who has any linkage whatsoever to Al-Qaeda. We should be deeply troubled that drug lords are now deemed as potentially directly supporting hostilities. And again, I'm reading between the lines because, of course, we don't know what the standards are.
And, of course, President Obama was himself a professor of law. So one wonders how he would look at the whole legality question, James.
Well, that's an interesting point. And I think like Paul could speak to this, too, because I quoted in my story to this effect. But, I mean, one of the things is, as we start to wrestle with the legitimacy and of this in international law is a lot of the other techniques that we have established for the global war on terror, if you will, enhanced interrogation techniques that the rest of the world saw as torture, extraordinary renditions where we got that wrong a few times to the point where the Italians have convicted 23 CIA agents in absentia. These Guantanamo, where you keep people in extrajudicial detention, we've seen time and again that these things come back to haunt us in a way. And I would be concerned if I'm the Obama administration that this better be on some pretty strong legal footing, or else it could come back to haunt us as well.
James Kitfield, he's senior correspondent for National Journal Magazine. You're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. We'll open the phones now first to Wyndham, Vermont. Good morning, Chris. You're on the air.
Good morning. Very interesting conversation. I studied a lot of armchair history, and I found that in the past, and not so far past, that we tried to capture or apprehend these enemies of our state or our countries and whatever to make them accountable. By just suicide, or not suicide, but assassination, we don't really get that accountability. I'm also worried that, you know, in the day of espionage, you can disguise your target, per se, that it might not be the person that you're really after. Is that a factor? And has warfare just gone to the point where we can't capture their flag anymore? They don't have one, and now we've gone to this measure.
Paul Pillar.
Well, on the second point, I tried to address that a moment ago. Chris is absolutely right. It is a factor. We've had cases of mistaken identity that have arisen in the Israeli cases, and sooner or later we're liable to have ones at least as embarrassing for us. On the first question about accountability, I think the overall concern of our officials, and I would have to agree with this approach, is the top priority is not so much accountability but saving lives in the future by preventing or reducing the risk of terrorist attacks. So I think what the response to Chris's first question would be is accountability is fine, but that can't take priority over the opportunity to prevent a future terrorist attack if we think that's what we're doing.
James Kitfield, what effect did the recent killing of the CIA agents in Afghanistan have on this program?
By all indications, it's ratcheted it up. There's been 12 drone strikes in Pakistan's lawless tribal regions where the network that attacked those CIA agents' forward operating base resides. That's a significant increase over what we'd seen prior to that attack. That attack shows you exactly what I was talking about, was this thing grew out of these hunter-killer teams that grew out of the battle space in Afghanistan and in Iraq. We have CIA agents out there who are doing human intelligence. You know, we've gotten very good at this, you must say. I mean, the CIA says, you know, privately, they think they've gotten 12 to 14 of the top 20 Al-Qaeda most wanted targets, which suggests that's not something some drone is wandering the countryside figuring out. That's something some human intelligence that we've gotten that has fingered that person and has told us where he is. The drone just basically verifies with its video that is indeed the person you think it is.
Now, do members of the CIA then go directly to Congress, to members of Congress, to report exactly what they've done?
Yes. I quote in my story Kit Bond, who's the ranking Republican on the Senate Intelligence Committee, who said, you know, it's clear that he's been, you know, Congress has been briefed on this. Congress has given it a stamp of approval. So I don't want to create the impression that this is a rogue executive branch
and
operation.
And, of course, Vice President Biden has expressed approval.
Yes. I mean, the administration as well as the intelligence committees have green-lighted this thing and in a way, in a dramatically increased level of these things.
Why do you suppose, having criticized the program during the election campaign, President Obama has now ratcheted up this program, Paul Pillar?
Well, 2 points. One, much of what we see reflects operational opportunities, information that is collected that we didn't have before. So we got to be cautious about seeing a pattern of, you know, more strikes now than before and concluding that strategy has changed or an approach has changed. But point number two is, you know, having opposed the Iraq war from the very beginning, being under obvious political pressure to show that he's a tough guy with regard to the AFPAC theater and terrorists, that's an additional incentive for him to pursue this program.
Paul Pillar of Georgetown University. He's a former CIA National Intelligence Officer. We'll take a short break. More of your calls, your comments when we return. Stay with us.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by American University, by the George Lucas Educational Foundation, creator of Edutopia, your source for what works in public education. Learn more at edutopia.org. By Jonathan Cutchins, recognizing NPR's coverage of educational issues across the United States. And by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. This is NPR.
After 2 years of free fall, the U.S. economy appears to be stabilizing. But Nobel Prize-winning economist Joseph Stiglitz argues deeper problems in the global financial system must be addressed to create a more equitable world. The Diane Rehm Show, next hour. We're talking about drone strikes, lethal covert actions. The CIA has apparently taken out many of the most wanted high-value targets in Pakistan and Afghanistan by the use of drones, special operations forces. Some of the citizens of Pakistan have been upset, James. Others are in favor of doing exactly this kind of operation on the part of the United States because I gather that these terrorists are blowing up their mosques, their schools, and they're taking out civilians.
Sure. We've seen that time and again. I mean, they took over the Swat Valley. They basically rule in South and North Waziristan. They impose this very, you know, 7th century fundamentalist Sharia law A lot of people don't like it. People who actually have to live under this situation where people are beheaded in the town square or stoned for adultery to death, these kinds of things, tend to have a different view from the people in Islamabad who are much more urbane and look at this as just an infringement on their sovereignty.
All right. To St. Louis, Missouri. Good morning, Chaz. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning. I have a few comments. I'm so sad that everyone has bought into this propaganda term, war on terror. Why don't we call it the war on fear, the war on ill at ease? It's not a war. That involves armies, borders, generals, presidents, someone who can surrender. This is a legality matter. It's a law and order matter. And we keep talking about the efficacy of these things or the legality of them. What about the morality of it? We're giving the terrorists so much ammunition against us in the war for minds and hearts. All these things that we do that we say are extrajudicial, extra is outside of, so outside the law, that's outlaw. All these programs are outlaw programs. I think it's totally counterproductive. And I'd like to hear someone, we kill 8 innocents getting the head of the Taliban, Al-Qaeda in Pakistan. He killed 50 innocents in the hotel bombing. How does that make us better? Because we killed 42 less innocent people?
Hannah Shamsi.
Well, Chaz is talking about the legitimacy point and the important point of not only acting within the rule of law, but being seen to act within the rule of law.
I think he's also speaking about the morality as well as the legality.
And right, it is both. It is a moral issue. It's also an ethical issue. It is the reason that we have a system of laws that expresses moral and ethical judgment and that provides guidance in these situations. We talked earlier about the likelihood of mistakes being made. The United States' answer to questions from the United Nations, for example, about what is the legality of this program, can you disclose your legal analysis, what safeguards do you have in place to ensure that you're meeting your obligation to minimize civilian casualties, what accountability mechanisms are in place for a retrospective review, and the answer is, don't worry, trust us, we've got the law in place and we've done our legal analysis. And you know, trust us just isn't enough. Nations are not fallible and mistakes are made. So, for example, with the killing of Bait al-Masud, which James talked about, Jane Mayer, in an October 2009 article in The New Yorker, talks about what it took, in fact, to kill Masud. It took 16 strikes over a period of 14 months, and between 207 and 321 people died. We don't know how many of those were civilians, how many of those were not. And we don't know what the legal framework was, again, the legal framework that expresses our moral and ethical judgment when you are in the context of war, assuming that the context of war applies. And when it does not, previous caller was right, we don't necessarily have armed conflict. We don't have armed conflict around the world. And to treat it that way not only goes against the law of war, it minimizes legitimacy.
James Kitfield.
A couple of interesting points. The ACLU, after this came out, has filed a Freedom of Information Act request to find out what are the justifications, what are the evidentiary bars, et cetera. They may be rebuffed, but then that allows them to go to the courts and challenge that. On the civilian versus military, I've seen there's been different, you know, the administration thinks, you know, scores of civilian versus hundreds of militants. The New America Foundation did a pretty in-depth report of this. They estimate 250 civilians versus 500 militants. Obviously, some human rights groups estimate much higher. The problem is you don't know because these are lawless regions. There's no place for the government to go. I mean, the Pakistani government does not go into these places and do a body count afterwards. And it's hard, very hard. These people don't wear uniforms, so it's very hard to tell civilians from combatants or militants. But the overall point is correct. There is a blowback to this. There is a moral issue here. And that's not to say that when you balance these things, you would never do this, but it is to say that you'd like to know how it is balanced.
Exactly. Bob from Raleigh, North Carolina, you're on the air.
Hi. I wonder if anybody might know the process by which these death sentences are imposed, particularly who imposes them, a committee? And does it go all the way to the top? How are these death sentences imposed?
And that goes back to the question of criteria, Paul Pillar.
Well, in terms of how they're imposed, basically what we know is what we know through the energetic reporting of James Kitfield. We haven't had official pronouncements that answer Bob's question. But the big missing thing, which you put your finger on right at the outset of the show, Diane, is what the criteria are. We've heard about the briefings to the intelligence committees. The intelligence committees certainly have to play an important role in this. They've sort of approved the program in general, but by what criteria? And especially when you talk about expanding things from terrorists to drug lords and so on, exactly what are the criteria that are applied to each case? We still haven't heard that.
James.
And let me just say what we do know. We do know that there's no one master list. There's multiple lists. And these lists are gathered by commands, i.e. the U.S. command in Iraq or the U.S. command in Afghanistan, who looks at the terrorists in his area of operations and says, we need to take these guys out. You have the CIA, which is tasked for taking out al-Qaeda. So al-Qaeda, CIA will have its own list of al-Qaeda senior leadership. Those lists end up all after being vetted at the local level, end up at the level of the National Security Council. So that doesn't, which implies to me, that's what I got from the senior official. Level of the National Security Council implies cabinet level officials, you know, maybe some subgroup of the National Security Council look at these things and then give the thumbs up or thumbs down. And eventually, I believe the list, now this I don't know for sure, are signed off on by President Obama. That list is assembled under presidential authority. So he clearly knows when these things are done in his name.
So it does not go to the Congress then?
No. No, the target list does not go to Congress. Now, whether Congress is brief after the fact,
right.
I suspect they are, and I suspect they've signed off on this. And on the drug lord, I mean, that was actually reported by the Senate Foreign Relations Committee report on the drug trade in Afghanistan, and I think they kind of gave us a glimpse under the skirts, if you will, that said that they have the evidentiary bar is two human intelligence sources plus quote-unquote substantial additional information. So that is the evidentiary bar they're using, at least for the drug lords in the targeted list in Afghanistan.
Here's an email on that very subject from Lauren, who says, I noted the inclusion of drug lords in the list of targets with reference to their role in financing terror. We could take care of that problem by ending the senseless war on drugs, the only effect of which is to direct money to drug traffickers. Paul Pillar.
Well, the connection between the drug trafficking and how the Afghan Taliban is involved in it is not nearly as direct with al-Qaeda and the terrorists that we're most concerned with as some people might suppose. I would commend the most recent annual report on counterterrorism put out by the American Security Project, which was just recently published, and that addresses this topic, pointing out that the best judgment of those who have looked at this is that al-Qaeda does not profit, you know, from the drug trade that is being conducted by the Taliban or others in Afghanistan to any significant degree.
All right. To Traverse City, Michigan. Good morning, Josh.
Good morning. My comment, as I've listened to your guests, I see in my opinion that the real issue is the checks and balances with regards to the decisions of who was put on these lists. And I think Iraq is a good example of when you look at the civilian casualties, with a massive troop presence, I believe that counterterrorism with regards to intelligence, that's where we use our superiority, our military superiority and our intelligence gathering superiority. I believe that's the way, countless lives would be saved, because obviously any terrorist is not abiding by international wartime laws.
And that goes to the pro side of this operation.
Absolutely. And again, we have gotten some very bad people who have a lot of blood in their hands. I mean, I go back to Zarqawi in Iraq. I mean, that guy had thousands of probably lives on his hands because he was responsible for al-Qaeda in Iraq's bombing of mosques, the Golden Dome Mosque. They bomb marketplaces on a regular basis, et cetera. On the point of checks and balances, I mean, I take that point. I think that's really where the discussion comes down to is, you know, we're being told, as Hannah said, that trust us, there are checks and balances. We do know that this is briefed to Congress. That is one check and balance. But we don't know a lot beyond that. It does raise questions when you see drug lords added to the list because the drug lords are supporting the Taliban and the Taliban is linked to al-Qaeda. So you've already, again, a triple bank shot of who can be targeted here. Suggests to me that a little more scrutiny on exactly how you end up on this target list would be probably a good thing.
To Williamsburg, Virginia. Good morning, Jeff.
Good morning, Diane. I love your show. Thank you for having me on.
Thank you.
Wanted to briefly introduce a couple of terms. I'm in the reserves, but I'm in a civilian status today, so I can speak as a citizen. But I wanted to contribute to the conversation that a couple of callers ago raised about what is and what is not lawful. There are a couple of terms of art that every member of the military knows because we all undergo annual law of armed conflict training, and it's really not erudite or difficult to understand, so I'll just quickly throw them out there. Discrimination, military necessity, proportionality. Clearly, U.S. forces and coalition forces ought to be held to the law of armed conflict, but I'm disappointed that the media so frequently fails to hold the opposing forces up to those. First of all, discrimination. U.S. forces try to kill uniform combatants, but when the enemy chooses not to wear a uniform and intentionally tries to blend with the civilian population, that's a war crime. It's very clear, the Geneva Conventions, many people who talk about this clearly haven't read them, but that's a war crime to do that. So that prevents the United States from easily applying discrimination to determining the military necessity of killing an enemy combatant. Secondly, military necessity. The law of armed conflict doesn't require us to wait until the adversary kills one of our people or one of our forces, one of our civilians. It's completely lawful to kill somebody who is exhibiting hostile intent. A hostile act does not necessarily have to occur. So if these al-Qaeda people giving operational direction from Pakistan, we've established that they are in fact doing that, it's completely lawful and we have military necessity in killing them. And finally, proportionality. When we do this with a Hellfire missile, rather small warhead from a drone, it's about as discriminate as you can get. And given the circumstances, it's completely consistent with the law of armed conflict, and it's far more discriminating and far more consistent with the law of armed conflict than our adversaries hold themselves to. And disappointingly, the media, I feel, doesn't hold the adversary to any standard whatsoever, and I think that's unfortunate. And
Jeff, thanks for calling, and you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Hannah Shumsey, how do you feel about those comments in regard to discrimination, necessity, and proportionality?
Well, I want to start by addressing the first comment that Jeff made, which is that the adversary themselves don't discriminate and have killed people. There's a United Nations report that recently came out that talked about the fact that over 3,000 civilians have been killed by al-Qaeda and Taliban forces in Afghanistan. And that recognition, the recognition that, for example, the enemy is conducting and committing war crimes is absolutely well taken. But that doesn't absolve the United States of its own obligation to act in accordance with either the laws of war or other domestic law enforcement laws when the law of armed conflict doesn't apply. And when Jeff is talking about discrimination, necessity, proportionality, yes, those are exactly the terms that we referred to or I referred to earlier on in the show. And we simply don't know enough about how those are being applied, and especially applied with respect to the CIA. And I really wanted to make that point here. The military is trained to the Geneva Conventions, and the Geneva Conventions in many ways are part of the DNA of the military. The CIA doesn't have the same background or the same training. And so the real question is, when you've got a program which is a program in which significant numbers of people are being killed, where is the accountability? How does the CIA determine and apply discrimination, necessity, proportionality?
Paul what Pillar, evidence? Do you want to comment?
There is an entire legal process, you know, apart from the law of war, that governs everything the CIA does on these things. We have laws governing covert action, a very elaborate procedure involving notifications, memoranda, and covert action findings. careful review processes involving the president signing off on things. So everyone involved in that agency doing anything of this nature, it may be a different kind of DNA that flows through, that they have, but it's certainly DNA, and it certainly has to do with legality.
James Kitfield, summarize for us what's happening here and how the program is likely to proceed.
Well, what's happening is this program has grown and grown. It's effective, and it's basically got senior level support in the administration and in Congress. And so we're going to see this thing grow. And what concerns me, again, not that the program can't be justified. I don't believe that. I think for some people you can certainly justify this, especially when you cannot reach them with the long arm of the law. You have then the rules of armed conflict do apply, it seems to me. However, there's just so much we don't know about it. And we've seen already with the escalation towards drug traffickers being on the target list, with the CIA contracting it out, hit squads to private contractors. If you don't have programs like this that operate in the light of day, they tend to gravitate towards bad places.
James Kitfield of National Journal. His article is titled Wanted Dead, all about the Obama administration's use of targeted assassinations in the war against Al-Qaeda. Paul Pillar of Georgetown University, Anna Shamsi at the New York University School of Law. Thank you all so much.
Thank you.
Thanks, Diane.
And thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Susan Neighbors, Denise Couture, and Monique Nazareth. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dori Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe, and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information.